Without further ado, then, let us begin. A number of people have contacted me, so I do want to make a few comments in response to their questions. However, I can't, if Shoham or tech support, I can't open up the document mechanism. I'm not able to open up anything on the screen now. So I'll talk while, oh, there it is. Okay, I got it. Just want to show everyone. Here's a picture of Chaim Grada. Not such a good picture. Let me get a better picture. Bill Weiss. I don't know if Bill will be. He's with us. He was nice enough to call my attention to an article which I saw but I'd forgotten by Alan Nadler in Tablet. You can see all sorts of interesting things about Chaim Grada. I did want to clarify what I said last class about Navardic, and this is in response to another question. First, let me say, though, that I misspoke last class when I spoke about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He became Rebbe in 1951, so the Chazon Ish was still alive. We spoke a bit about the Chazon Ish. He could have made some comments about the Rebbe, but as far as I know, he didn't. And the Rebbe didn't really become a major figure till the Chazon Ish's passing. I was asked last class about Navardic and about the status of Torah learning. So let me tell you what I received in an email. Someone who's listening to the classes, he's not live with us. He's a Lubavitcher named Moshe Gerari, and he sent me, he sent me a text, a Chabad text, the memoirs of a Rabbi Yehuda Chitrik, in which it describes how certain Balabatim would praise the Yeshiva Bachrim at Chabad, at Lubavitch, because they thought that unlike the Navardic students, the Lubavitch students actually were serious learners. And this goes back to the question I discussed last class. I was asked about Torah learning in Navardic, and I said that there is the reputation that they were not so serious because they were involved in Musar and other things. However, the Sipur shows that this is not always the case. But the fact that it was often the case is seen by this memoir. And I will say that it is true, as I said last class, that Navardic did not produce great scholars, with certain exceptions, of course. But that wasn't Navardic's goal. Its goal was to produce great Jews. You can say the same thing about Hirsch's school in Frankfurt. It wasn't to produce Gedolim. It was to produce great people. This Moshe Gerari, he also sent me a comment, so I'll tell you about the Strimal of the Stipler. He claims that when the Stipler's son, Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, married the daughter of Rabbi Yoshev, Rabbi Yoshev gave the Stipler the Strimal of his grandfather, who's known as the Leshem, Rishlomo Yoshev, who was a great Mekuba, a great Kabbalist. And from that point on, the Stipler wore this Strimal at Sholoshuddas, Suda Shlishit. And he says, as far as he knows, Rabbi Chaim doesn't wear the Strimal, but as we saw, that's perhaps not correct. A couple other things. Is Marjorie with us? If not, I will wait till next. Yes, she is with us. Marjorie sent me something very interesting, which I had seen. But I will tell you right now, because I think everyone will find it interesting. You know, lots of things. Basically, we've done so many Gedolim and so many great figures that almost every week there's things that are relevant. In fact, I was in Chicago yesterday. There was a big Eliezer Berkovitz conference in Chicago, though I'll let you know when they put the talks online. David Ellenson, president of PB Union College, is one of the speakers, and he spoke very nicely. Lots of things we do. And it's not just that what we do, then we find things in the news that is relevant. Sometimes what we do actually makes the news, at least in a smaller sense. I'm happy to say that wherever I go, people are listening to the classes, but I'll be speaking at a Sephardic shul in a few weeks, and they wanted me to speak on both Rabbi Kafich and Rabbi Ben Amozig. And that, of course, comes from the classes we've had here. There was an article in all the Israeli papers about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago about how Israeli soldiers or Israeli spies went undercover and infiltrated into Palestinian territory. This is talking in the 1950s, actually married Arab women, had children, all the while they were spies. And now you can speak about the morality of this. That's a different question. But when they finally revealed when it was time to come back to Israel, they couldn't leave their wives or family, as you can imagine. They revealed to their wives, who obviously were quite shocked, but their wives agreed that they would convert. And the whole story is about how what happened 60 years later. It's now being revealed, these spies, their children, but they went to Paris. And Rav Goren came to Paris, and he made a base in there, and he converted the wives. Now, the article says that he did not convert the children because he thought that under these circumstances, the children did not need to be converted. They were already regarded as Jewish. Now, this is clearly incorrect. I do not believe this for a minute. The halakha is clear. Even Rav Goren, who had strange views, would never do something like that. Not to mention the fact that converting children is very easy. They don't need to accept Torah and Mitzvot, according to many, including Ramosha Feinstein. It doesn't matter what type of family they're in, you can convert them. So if he's already going ahead to convert the women, of course he would convert the children. It makes no sense to me otherwise, and I don't believe it. As for the other issue of this practice of being a spy and marrying someone else, having sexual relations, etc., Rav Goren speaks about it in this book, Mishnat HaMedina. He has an entire essay called Halachic Problems in the Shin Bet and in Mossad. And he thinks that this is, you know, as an emergency measure, these sorts of things are sometimes permissible, necessary. He has all sorts of the story of Esther, which is coming up, is a source he can use. And he says there's a Samchut Miyuchedet, there's a special position of those who are responsible for the security of Israel. Finally, one more thing. Yes, the current issue of Tehumen is written by Rabbi Ari Shvat. If I'm not mistaken, his father was principal of SAR years ago. He teaches at the various yeshivas, and he wrote an article in English. It's translated into, I think it's the honey pot, which is when you have, let's say, use a woman to seduce someone from an important person from the other side. And he has a whole article on this, and it was actually picked up in the newspapers, and he discusses the different details of it. Finally, Yonatan Rossman, he doesn't listen live to us, but he's quite a Talmud Chacham. He's published a few Svarim. And he wrote me two comments, which I do want to share with you, because I think they're really interesting. I have other comments, and if we finish with the Stipor today, we'll get to them. This is our fourth class on the Stipor, if not next class. You will recall from last semester, I spoke about the book on Rav Yoshev and how it portrays him as really having no family life, and we spoke about how sad that is. He calls my attention to the fact, which I read but did not remember, that in Making of a Gadol, page 1099, he quotes the Leshem. That's Rav Yoshev's grandfather, as saying about Rav Yisrael Salanter, that he took no pleasure from this world, he despised honor, hated money, and left no spot in his heart for loving his children. The three foundations of man's pleasure in this world. That is, the foundations of man's pleasure is honor, money, and love of children. I actually would create a distinction. I think the first two are fleeting, but the last one is fundamental. But he says that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter didn't have it in his heart to love his children. Maybe he's talking about the fact that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter saw his role to fix the Jewish people as a whole. So I think that's worth noting. And then he calls to my attention is something else. We spoke a good deal about antinomianism, about the idea of sense of the faithful, that sometimes the sense of the Jewish people of what's right is able to trump halacha minutia. And we spoke about how it's certainly able to trump the views of the Gedolim, but even able to trump halacha. I gave examples of that. And in Making of a Gadol, page 1188, he brings another example of this. This is Rabbi Rossman brings this to my attention. He quotes his father, that is the Kamenetsky, or Yaakov Kamenetsky, who gave the Bachrim at the Slobodka Yeshiva the halachic permission to marry at so late an age. They would marry in their mid-20s, late-20s, sometimes even as late as 30 years old. And Rabbi Kamenetsky answered that this Yiddish expression, that the little fiddle plays on its own. What does that mean? That when there is a position that's of crucial importance to Jewry, such as increasing the number of intelligent Jews, getting more years of Torah study, etc., halachic minutiae are set aside. That is, there's sometimes when the people feel that, I think it's the people here, not the rabbis. No rabbi ever wrote a responsum. But the people feel that it's important for there to be intensive Torah study. Halachic minutia is set aside. And Rabbi Rostman thinks, and I agree, that this is a form of antinomianism. I think a parallel would be what I've spoken about Chaim Soloveitchik's point, that the idea that people commit suicide rather than convert to Christianity or kill their children, these are not positions, certainly not killing your children, which you can find halachic justification for, but again, it was the sense of the faithful that the rabbis never told them to do this, but this antinomian sense from the people that they must do this. And this overrides any concerns with halacha. And one more point. Because I mentioned the book Hashakdan about Rabbi Eliyashiv, in this new book, about Rav Avraham Shapiro. We had classes on Rav Avraham Shapiro, but this book was not yet available when this just came out the end of last year, so I couldn't discuss it when I dealt with Rav Avraham Shapiro. But he talks about a certain sage. He doesn't tell us who it is, but it's clearly Rabbi Eliyashiv. One of the great sages of the generation. There's a story here that people were sitting with Rav Avraham Shapiro, and one of the students said about this great sage that he's a great tzaddik. And Rav Avraham asked him, well, why do you think he's a great tzaddik? And he replied, because he's always very serious. I've never seen him laugh or smile. He's never in a happy mood. And Rav Avraham replies, you don't know. That's because he has ulcers. I don't know. I mean, you can determine it. If Rav Yosef has ulcers, then speak about him. And then it says that Rav Avraham spoke about this great sage, which there's no questions for Rabbi Yashiv, other aspects that he knew personally, which other people didn't know, but then Rabbi Yashiv said, don't think that someone's a tzaddik just because they don't know how to smile. There's often other reasons why people don't smile. You can be a true tzaddik even with a good sense, you know, a smiling, happy personality. And earlier on page 164, you see just the opposite of Rabbi Yashiv, that Rav Avraham speaks about how being on the Beis Din and seeing all the problems that he was confronted with so affected him that he had to take up smoking, and it drove him, he couldn't have a nice peace. And we saw Rav Eliyashiv, he said that he's able to shut it all out. It doesn't affect him at all. And we spoke about that, two different personalities. Okay, I'm going to now make the picture a little bigger. Let's see if I can do this. I'm going to have to close it soon because I want to show you something. But for now, I'm going to make it bigger. This is in response to those who want to see a bigger face. So let's see. Okay. I think that will make you happy, whoever wanted it. I can easily make it smaller. Oh, actually, this is no good because I have to move it over, or I want to be able to see the questions. Let me make it a little smaller, and then I can see the questions, hopefully. Mm-hmm. So I'm having a... I can see the questions, basically. I can't... If tech support can move it over a little bit. If not, okay, I can see the questions. Okay, if anyone has any questions on what I said, if not, let us go on. If you recall last class, and as I said, this is the fourth class on Rabbi Kanievsky, I think we should be able to finish it today. If not, it'll just be a little bit more next time. I'm going to turn off make it a little less bright, the screen. I ended last class talking about his position with regard to Zionism. I said that, unlike many others, or maybe I didn't say this, we'll pick up here, Rav Eliyashiv felt that it was an obligation to vote in Israeli elections. And unlike others who thought this, Rav Eliyashiv was greatly respected. Rav Kanievsky was greatly respected by those to his right. That is, the ones... who vigorously refused to take part in the electoral process. In response to their protests, he strongly defended his position. Yet in these defenses, you do find great respect for those on the right, a respect which is not found for those on the left, that is, the religious Zionist rabbis. And the Stipler even acknowledges that the Satmar Rav, Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, was correct in his fundamental point, namely that the establishment of a state was a violation of the oath that the Talmud speaks about, these oaths that the Jews swore, one of them, not to rebel against the nations. The Satmar Rav says that it was forbidden to establish the State of Israel. for halachic reasons. But now that the state is in existence, he doesn't understand the Satmar position. He doesn't understand why it should be regarded than any other pre-World War II states in which Jews served in their parliament. The state is now a de facto. It's a reality. But he agrees that it shouldn't have been established. So in practice, the Stipe-Wurst position is no different than all the other Haredi, his Haredi colleagues, the members of Agudas Yisrael. But his agreement with the Satmar Rav that the establishment of the State of Israel was in violation of Halakha is quite significant. It puts the Stipe-Wurst not only in the minority, in a tiny minority when it comes to the Lithuanian rabbinate. The Lithuanian rabbinate as a whole did not have such Halakha considerations. We spoke about Rav Henkin, who opposed the establishment of the state, but that was because he was afraid that there would be a war and Jews would be killed, or they'd be destroyed, and others thought that the secularists would take over. But if it would be a halachic state, or if the Orthodox were a majority, the view that there's something wrong with establishing a state was found by very, very few. In fact, Agudas Yisrael, as a whole, voted in 1937 in support of the state. And if you look at the arguments of the people who were opposed to it, the minority, it was for the pragmatic reasons. And here the Stipe-Wurst, and we get a clear sense from of his extremism in this sense, in this position, that he was anti-Zionist to the core, not for pragmatic reasons, believing that it was forbidden halakhically to establish a state. And I think that helps explain the negative views we said before. I would include, in terms of the extreme views of the Stipe-Wurst, his relentless opposition to all governmental religious bodies. It is a bit ironic in that his mechutan, the person who he makes a shidduch with, is Rabbi Yoyashiv, who was serving on the Beis Din. So the Stipe-Wurst would have been able to distinguish between great Talmidei Chachamim who are serving for the religious courts connected to the state and his theoretical and his practical position. But he was strongly opposed to it, and once Rabbi Gorin was elected chief rabbi, his opposition was magnified. He, in one of his letters, he writes to one who wanted to take the test to become a dayan, that, quote, one is not permitted to desecrate the name of heaven in order to earn a livelihood. Now, the Stipe-Wurst regarded Rav Gorin as no less than a reform rabbi. So when Rav Gorin is the chief rabbi, it's obvious that you cannot work for the courts of the state. But even before that, complete opposition. Even when the chief rabbinate organized ostensibly innocuous gatherings of rabbis or synagogue leaders for various purposes, the Stipe-Wurst would send out letters urging people not to attend. These are gatherings that Haredi rabbis, people like Rabbi Yechezkel Sarna, would attend, would be involved with. But the Stipe-Wurst would be very much opposed to it. His fear, much like the Chazon Ish and the Brisker Rav in the earlier generation, was that the religious Zionists would use these gatherings to institute religious changes and, in general, assume a position of power in the Orthodox world. In fact, his negative view of the chief rabbinate and of Mizrahi rabbis in general is well illustrated by his refusal to attend the 1935 funeral in Tel Aviv of a certain well-known Mizrahi rabbi. That's how it is described in both the biography of him and in another work about the Stipe-Wurst. There's no question that this 1935 rabbi would be Rav Shlomo Aronson, who was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He dies in 1935. And the Stipe-Wurst explained the reason he doesn't go is because there's no obligation of Kavod HaTorah for a Mizrahi rabbi. Am I right on the years? I have to check the years, actually. Maybe it's not 1935. I'm thinking, I think it's 1935. Is that the year Rabbi Soloveitchik went there, or was it 2 years earlier? After he died, then there was the election Rabbi Soloveitchik ran, and Rabbi Herzog ran, and also Rabbi Amiel, who was elected chief rabbi. I believe it's 1935. That's when Robinson runs, yeah. And Robinson dies. So what does the Stipe-Wurst, how does he explain it? He says there is no obligation of Kavod HaTorah, of respect for Torah sages, if they are religious Zionists. Now, if you read the literature of the Stipe-Wurst, this is to be expected that he would feel this way. You won't find this in the English literature, because that sort of will The jig will be up. The secret will be revealed. The Agudo world wants, in America at least, not in Israel, wants people to think that they respect great rabbis who are not of the Aguda variety. And the opposition always says it's not true. They only respect those on their side, and that they don't believe in Shivin Pani and 70 ways to the Torah. And they have Das Torah, one perspective. And you'll see people like Avi Shafran and others will say, no, it's not true. We do believe in respect for the Mizrahi-type rabbis. We just have a different position. But the Stifer says explicitly, there is no obligation to show respect to Mizrahi rabbis. Occasionally, there'll be a Mizrahi rabbi that he has a certain zechus, he does something which he deserves respect. But in general, there is no reason to respect. And anyone who reads Haredi literature knows that if they give him the title Harav, it's significant. Often, they don't even give him that title. It's just the last name. Anyone who reads Haredi literature, both in the popular variety and in the Torah variety, knows that there is absolutely no respect given to those who do not share the Lithuanian Das Torah. Oh, someone asked me why not the funeral. Rav Kook also died in 1935, so maybe they're talking about, but not attending his funeral. The problem is that Rav Kook, it's a good point, but Rav Kook's funeral was not in Tel Aviv. Rav Kook's funeral was in Jerusalem. But it is a good question. As to how he related to Mechutzen, as far as I know, the relationship was very good. I don't know if they spoke politics or anything like that. This extremism even extended to matters that other Haredi rabbis would have no problem with. And I keep stressing the extremism because if you want to understand how Haredi society developed in the last 30 years, we have to remember there are two models. There's the Jerusalem model and the B'nai Brak model. And the B'nai Brak model won out, and that didn't only influence Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, it also influenced Haredi Orthodoxy around the globe. During the Yom Kippur War, it was suggested in B'nai Brak used to have a lot of religious Zionists, or at least there was a community of them. It was suggested to bring all the children from the various schools together. That is, the Haredi schools, the religious Zionist schools, so they could say Tehillim and pray together at the same time. And the people in the Haredi community who put forth this idea, their notion was that the prayers of the children would go up to heaven and it would reflect well if all divisions would cease. Their attitude was that the adults fight and they don't get along, but at least children can get together. There's no distinction between the children, and you get the children in the same room, kippah serugah and Haredi dress, and let them say Tehillim together. And this is something that other Haredi rabbis would think is a great idea. The Stifer's response was quite severe, asserting that this is absolutely forbidden, and that for Haredi children to have any contact with religious Zionist youth would have terrible consequences and must therefore be avoided. For him, religious Zionism was like a plague, and therefore those who carried it, as it were, should be avoided as much as possible. And while it's okay sometimes for adults to have dealings with the religious Zionists because their hashkafa, their outlook has already been formed, when it comes to the youth who are more susceptible to being negatively influenced, you must keep them completely separate. And I think if we understand this, we can understand why in places like Emmanuel, in the playground, an actual wall is put up and fences are put up in other places to literally keep some children away from the regular Haredi children, because in that case it was the Sephardic children. The idea is that children can be negatively influenced, and it's an outlook that is so foreign, I think, from all of ours, and so foreign even from many in the Haredi world, but this is the Stifer's position. I'm not saying he's talking about the Sephardic schools. I mean, he wasn't dealing with that, but when you see his outlook that children need to be kept far away from anyone who doesn't share the Haredi outlook, you can see where the idea would come from that we have to put in a wall between the two. It's precisely with regard to how to relate to the chief rabbinate and the rabbinic courts that we see the difference between the Stifer and his Mechutzen Rav Eliashiv, the Haredi leader today. I've spoken about this before, I'll say it again. Unlike the Stifer, Rav Eliashiv wants his followers to take over the chief rabbinate and the religious courts. Before Rav Eliashiv became the Gadol Hador of the Haredim, you didn't have any of the problems that the religious Zionist world is confronting today, because the Stipor's position, and then followed by Rav Shach, was that Haredim should have nothing to do with the religious courts. And therefore, the religious Zionists ran the chief rabbinate, they ran the religious courts. But once the Haredim start moving in, then you have all the issues of conversion and who's going to be the chief rabbi. All the problems of conversion that we're all affected with, they come from the fact that Rav Yoshev believes in conquering the chief rabbinate, because he was a member of it once, not in boycotting it. It's funny, because for a long time, the religious Zionist world, throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, they were very upset that the Haredim were not involved in the chief rabbinate. Their attitude was that as long as we get the, if we get the Haredim in, it'll moderate them, we can get along, there'll be unity, achdus, and when Rav Yoshev comes in and he starts telling his followers, yes, to take the Dayanus exam, which is a complete reversal of the previous approach. It's funny, because in Yatei Ne'eman today, they speak about how vital and how important it is to become Dayanim, and 20 years ago, they were saying just the opposite, that no Haredi will have anything to do with this. But the religious Zionists were very happy, because they thought that this meant a moderation in the Haredi world, that now they would have Batei Din, in which religious Zionists and Haredim would sit together. They thought that this would be signal tacit acceptance of the religious Zionist achievements, that is, of establishing the chief rabbinate and establishing the religious courts, and it didn't turn out this way. Today the Haredim have taken over a good portion, so much so that the religious Zionists are speaking in terms of opening a parallel religious court. Rabbi Stav from Sohar has spoken of that they need a new religious court system, just religious Zionists. So truthfully, you know, the religious Zionists, they create this system, and they say that they're in charge, they have complete control. The conservative Jews don't have any say in the matter, and they don't have the religious freedom to have their own rabbis do their marriages. And now when the Haredim take over, the religious Zionists are seeing what it feels like, what the conservative Jews have felt like so long, and that they don't feel that they have religious freedom. There is obviously today a great deal of nostalgia in the religious Zionist world for the 1970s and 1980s, when the Haredim were not interested in the chief rabbinate. If they could go back in time, they'd be much happier. Because today, if you follow the scene, you know that the Haredim have taken over to a certain extent, and this great institution, the chief rabbinate, and the religious court system, which the religious Zionists established, has been taken out from literally from under their legs. Other aspects of the Stipor's Weltanschauung, protection of the yeshiva world. Obviously, that's going to be a central aspect of his teachings. And it's only to be expected that he will be at the forefront of any efforts to open up schools, yeshivas that have secular studies. There's numerous letters that he signs in opposition to this. Even if these institutions are entirely career-oriented, to help people get a job, even if they're directed towards women, complete opposition. Although he did not oppose Beis Yaakov teaching foreign languages, but he did oppose Toro College, obviously Gross Kollel, all these sorts of things. He even signed, together with Rav Shach, a condemnation of Yehuda Levi's book, Sha'arei Talmud Torah, which had an approbation from Yaakov Kamenetsky and others, which supports a Torah Derech Eretz perspective. What Levi had done in his book is cite all the examples of the Talmud which speak about the value of work. Levi himself opposes study of the humanities. The only thing he believes in is study of the sciences and mathematics and the value of working for a living. And you could find lots of examples that speak about that. Not least among them that the Talmud says that every man must teach his son a trade, a profession. The Stipor rejects this. This book is put in Cheirim by the Stipor. And the reason is all those passages that speak about the dignity, the value of work, not surviving on charity, etc., according to the Stipor, these were only stated with reference to one who needed to make a living. However, someone who could be supported while studying, quote, God forbid to cease studying the Holy Torah. In other words, there is no value to work. There's no dignity of work, any of the things that Hirsch and others spoke about. Work is something you do if, unfortunately, you can't be supported by someone else. So, Nebuch, you have to go to work. So, a book like Levi's book, Sha'arei Talmud Torah, which was advocating work as valuable in and of itself, because you have a good self-esteem, don't have to be supported from charity. The Torah, the Gemara says that if you only have learning and you don't have work, it leads to all sorts of leads to sin and all sorts of other problems. The Stipor says absolutely not. That only refers to people. All these passages deal with people who are not able to be supported. This too explains why the Haredi world is so strong in its opposition to any sort of trade schools, vocational training. They have been open. In the last few years, a number of these places have opened up, but these are being done in opposition to the Haredi leadership. The masses are demanding it to a certain extent. And you'll see in 30 years, this will be standard, I think, in the Haredi world, and that will be the new Das Torah, and they'll be able to look, and when Aguda writes their history, they'll talk about how the Gedolim recognize the necessity of earning a living, and therefore they are at the forefront of establishing these schools. Just like in 30 years from now, no one is going to believe us when we tell them that our grandchildren will not believe us when we tell them that there are great rabbis who covered up sex abusers, who shuffled them from school to school, who didn't believe you have to report this to the police. Our grandchildren will not believe this. And they'll be able to read the Aguda history books, which talk about how the Gedolim were in the forefront. They saw this sexual abuse from the beginning, and they knew how dangerous it was. And therefore, they were at the forefront of ensuring that all these people were immediately removed from the yeshivas so they couldn't harm the children. That's going to be the Das Torah in 50 years, because that's going to be a good position in 50 years. They will not ever tell their readers that it was the masses who revolted against the rabbinic leaders with the internet and everything else and literally forced this issue. Those are two of my predictions. Did he attend Rav Cook's funeral? I have no idea. I do not know. Okay. What does he do with the Rambam's condemnation for relying on a community for money for Torah study? It's a good question, Yisrael, but the Stipor does not need to worry about the Rambam's condemnation, because the Rishonim already dealt with this, and they said that we reject the Rambam. Look at all the Rivash and others, the Tashbates, because remember, the Rambam's position is against rabbis also serving communities. And they pointed out that, no, we reject the Rambam. No one accepted the Rambam. Really, except for in Yemen, where they all worked. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a response to them, and he says that you have people today who they don't want to support Kollels, and they say they hold like the Rambam. And Rav Moshe says that the Rambam has many interesting and unusual positions, many chumras, and yet these people don't want to be machmir by the Rambam and any of his other chumras. There's only one area they want to hold by the Rambam in, and that's the Rambam's opposition to supporting Kollels. So Rav Moshe says that's the Yetzer Hara speaking. The Rambam hasn't been accepted for a long time. Yet there was an ethos in Germany and elsewhere that work was valuable. Not that there was anything in opposition to the supporting Torah students, but the Stipor was speaking about a whole community of Torah students. That there never was before B'nai Brak 40 years ago. And in response to Leo Levy's argument that this is not healthy, where everyone's sitting and learning, you need to have a group of people who work, and Chazal recognized that the learning full-time is only for elites, but for everyone else, work is not just necessary, but valuable and spiritually significant. It's to that position that the Stipor sees as nothing less than blasphemy. The Stipor recognized that he was the representative of Das Torah in his time, the one who carried on the tradition of the Chazon Ish. On all the big issues, the Stipor was the one out front. By the way, as I go through this and talk about his really extreme positions and so many issues, it is worth thinking about and it is worth reflecting on how he became accepted in the Haredi world, even the American Haredi world, and you'll see he didn't become accepted. He was a saint. There's no question about it. He was a saint. So in that sense, his saintliness caused him to achieve a certain acceptance as saint, but his ideas were not accepted. But because he was a saint, he was put on the pedestal. He's part of the canon where you can accept his greatness, but not accept everything he says. In Israel, he's more accepted, his views. As with his predecessors, obviously the Stipor was in the forefront, carried on the strong opposition to women being forced to do any sort of community service, be it army service or just national civilian service. While men might be able to withstand the irreligious pressures in such an environment, the Stipor says that women who are lightheaded, Nashim Da'atan Kalot, will be quickly led astray. Now, reading his letters, his two volumes of letters, you get the sense that he viewed himself as under great pressure in this role, that is, the authority of Das Torah. What do I mean when I say he viewed himself as under great pressure? It was becoming harder and harder, especially after 1967, and throughout the 70s, it was becoming harder and harder for the authentic Das Torah to hold its own. The lore of Zionism, given additional strength by Israeli military victories, was leading many rabbis and Talmidei Chachamim, men who should have known better, to succumb to the idol of religious Zionism. He refers to it as an idol. It was against this watering down of Torah Hashkafa that the Stipler was constantly on guard against. Think of great rabbis such as Rabbi Yecheskel Sarna, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, Rav Gustman, even Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky. They were not viewed as reliable when it came to Das Torah. This was certainly the case for Rav Kahaneman. Rav Kahaneman flew the Israeli flag at Ponevej on Yom Ha'atzmaut. To this day, the Israeli flag is flown at Ponevej on Yom Ha'atzmaut. Rav Schacht didn't support this. He didn't believe in this idea, but he said that the founder of the yeshiva, Rav Kahaneman, flew the flag, and therefore we don't change anything he did. But if Rav Schacht was able to make his own decisions, if he felt able to overrule the Ponevej Rav, which he didn't want to, he would not have this perspective. He didn't believe in flying the Israeli flag. Obviously, the Stipler didn't. These Gedolim and others, while the Stipler would respect their learning, they were not reliable. They had faltered in terms of Das Torah. They had accepted certain aspects of the religious Zionist approach, either recognizing the chief rabbinate, Hechel Shlomo, or Yecheskel Sarna goes to Hechel Shlomo. And this was under Chayram by the Stipler. They would speak publicly about, I mentioned Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. He gave a Kiddush every year on Yom Yerushalayim. They would speak, these rabbis I spoke about would speak during wartime and other times about the value of the soldiers. All these aspects, which are far from religious Zionism, these rabbis are not religious Zionists by any stretch of the imagination, yet they had an appreciation for what was achieved in the state of Israel. They showed Hakarat HaTov to the army. They were had close relationships with many great religious Zionist rabbis. They wrote for religious Zionist publications occasionally. They were no longer regarded as reliable when it came to Das Torah. They were not following the position of the Brisker Rav or of the Chazon Ish, and therefore you see how sometimes these rabbis are referred to in the letters of the Stipler, but they won't mention their names because they always leave them out. They'll have three dots, you know, this rabbi, you know, and three dots. There's one story about the Stipler going to a funeral of a certain great rabbi, but he mentions while they're going to the funeral that unfortunately this rabbi erred on when it came to Zionism. You get the sense from reading the letters that the Stipler saw himself as really last of the Mohicans, not that they were the ones who were not able to be bribed by the victories of the Israeli army. Their position never changed. After finding an ally in this regard in Rav Schacht, because Rav Schacht, there were many great figures. However, Rav Schacht's position on all these issues was identical to that of the Stipler. Really, the mirror image. The Stipler, as it were, raises up Rav Schacht. Stipler's older than Rav Schacht, and the two of them, for at least 10 years, share the leadership of the Haredi community. In proclamation after proclamation, they sign together. They launch the newspaper Yatei Neman, which becomes the official mouthpiece of the non-Hasidic Haredim. And it exists to this day, Yatei Neman, and just like in Rav Schacht's day and the Stipler's day, so too today, a position is not an official Das Torah in the Haredi world, that is the Lithuanian Haredi world, until it is published in Yatei Neman. When it's published in Yatei Neman, then we know it's official. Otherwise, it could be true, Rav Yoshev could believe this, but he might not believe it. That is when they hang up posters everywhere. But when it appears in Yatei Neman, a newspaper, that's when it is official. I think that this Rav Schacht's ascendance to power in the Haredi world, which is really a continuation of the Stipler, right? They talk about George Bush's George Bush number one's presidency as the third term of Reagan. Rav Schacht's ascendancy and his leadership of the Haredi community is just a continuation of the Stipler. And it was the Stipler, because of his confidence in Rav Schacht, not his confidence in his learning or anything like that. A lot of people are great sages. His confidence in matters of Das Torah, that Rav Schacht's position is the identical position of the Sleipur, which is the position of the Chazon Ish, and Rav Shach was close to the Chazon Ish, he was close to the Brisker Rav, so that's why Rav Shach assumes his position of authority, and after the Sleipur is passing, Rav Shach steps into this role. Understandably, in the Sleipur's writings, you find the typical Haredi insistence that even in non-halachic matters, you must follow the guidance of the Torah sages. But it's not just any Torah sages. It's the Sleipur, it's those who follow the true Das Torah. Together with this, he puts forth a very simple approach to faith. There's no sophistication here, and he doesn't want sophistication. He says that we do not polemicize with non-Orthodox positions, because by doing so, it's possible the faithful will be exposed to these heresies and thus be led astray. You have many authors who were interested in polemicizing. They took various either non-Orthodox positions or even religious Zionist positions and explained them and then showed why they are wrong. The Sleipur was against this. Put forth your position. When he condemns the religious Zionists, he doesn't go into any details. He just says, that's not our way, it's against Das Torah, it's idolatry. But our role is, he says, when it comes to faith, the simple old faith. He even opposes publication of certain medieval philosophical classics. We no longer need the Morin of Uchim, Rav Sadia Gaon, or the rest. These works were interested in polemicizing as showing the defects in the opposing positions because the Jewish people were dealing with this at the time. The Sleipur thinks that in today's day and age, we're not confronted by any ideological challenges. Our approach today must therefore be to indoctrinate our followers with true Torah beliefs. Since we're not confronted with ideological challenges, we no longer need to deal with the ideological challenges. And it's dangerous because, as I said, it'll open up people. People might find the challenge more compelling than the response. So we see a paternalistic approach to faith, and we see this as well in an interesting letter, really a fascinating letter, which I'm going to be writing about in the first chapter to my book on censorship. The Sleipur was approached by someone who wanted to write about the Haskalah movement and its devastating results for traditional Judaism. However, he was not sure how he should deal. Well, he wasn't sure how he should deal with the notorious Saul Berlin, who forged a volume of responsa and attributed it to the Rush. Now, let me explain who this Saul Berlin was. It's not interesting that in his response, you'd think from what I just said that the Sleipur would have said to this person, we don't need a book about the Haskalah movement at all. People don't even need to know about this. He doesn't really say that. He just deals with one area. I don't think the Sleipur per se had any interest in writing books about the Haskalah movement. I just mentioned that he was interested in simple faith. But he was asked particularly one question, and he responded to this question. I don't know what, I think if he was asked about the book as a whole, he would have given a different answer. In the 18th century, there was a person named Shaul Berlin, Saul Berlin, a great sage, really a good old. He was the Rav of Frankfurt am Oder, the son of Zvi Hirsch Berlin, Zvi Hirsch Levin, the Rav of Berlin, also known as Berlin. This Shaul Berlin got involved with Maskilim, the early Maskilim, the Mendelssohn crowd, and it's hard to say if there was like a modern orthodoxy in those days, if he would have drifted towards that. It's hard to say if he was interested in modern orthodoxy or if he is really interested in totally uprooting traditional Judaism. I think the latter. He publishes a volume of responsa. It comes out with the approbation of his father and with the note of Yehuda's approbation, which he tells us he found, he acquired it from someone. It was collected by this rabbi a few hundred years before, and it contains responsa of the great Rabbi Asher ben Yechiel the Rush, as well as other medieval sages. It wasn't long after the book was published that people began to study it, and they noticed that there were a number of responsa in there which were quite strange, and it was impossible that the Rush could have written these responsa. Responsa that undermine traditional Judaism, reformist responsa. Throughout, the Sleipur actually thought that there might be some authentic responsa here, and Saul Berlin just forged the rest. I don't think so. I think Saul Berlin, there's no evidence of that at all. I think Saul Berlin forged, I think it's over 300 shuvot, that he forged the entire volume, and then he has a commentary on the volume, and that the unordinary shuvot, the ones that don't raise any eyebrows, he just put those in as cover for the 30 or so responsa, which really uproot traditional Judaism. He mocks traditional Judaism in there. As we keep going, we'll have classes, and I can deal in more detail with Shaul Berlin. It would take me a good half hour to go through some of the responsa on what he's doing. Basically, it is a heretical volume in the name of some of our greatest sages. He was a nephew of the Note of Yehuda. What's the relationship again, Bill? How was he a nephew of the Note of Yehuda? I forget. I know the Note of Yehuda. In fact, I'm researching the Note of Yehuda quite well because of the trip we're taking to this summer. But I can't recall the... if you can tell me, Bill, exactly the relationship to the Note of Yehuda, because I don't remember that. So if you got it there. If not, I will get it next class. Let me make a note of this. All these rabbis, by the way, were related to each other. They were all cousins and brother-in-laws and everything. But I didn't remember that he was actually his brother-in-law. I mean, actually his uncle. But if you have the information there, if not, next class I will get the exact information. A lot of the other great rabbis were the Note of Yehuda's nephews, and his son married a daughter of great rabbis, things like that. Yisrael asks, oh no, sorry, so let's go on. Bill is typing it. So what to do? You have to write about, if you're doing Haskalah, you have to write about, I'm sure they're great shiurim, but I don't know that that's not a proof that the Note of Yehuda is his uncle. The Note of Yehuda did not have any brothers who were great Torah sages, and he didn't have any sisters who married Ritzi Berlin. So I don't know how the Note of Yehuda could have been his uncle, unless you're saying he's a great uncle or something like that. If you tell me that Rabbi Rakefet said he's an uncle, that's not a proof. So, but I will get the exact relationship next class, if there is indeed a relationship, because I have to confess that I don't recall there being any close relationship. Cousins, all these rabbis were cousins. That doesn't say anything. Third cousins, fourth cousins, they all were related, because the rabbinic elite intermarried with each other. But I do not recall. Rav Shaul Berlin's brother was Hirschleben, who becomes chief rabbi of... Solomon Herschel, who becomes the first chief rabbi of England. But now that I think of it, Solomon Herschel does have a relationship to the Note of Yehuda. Okay, I'll check on this. I can't do everything on regular achas. When you say he's a bit more positive, I'm assuming Rakevitz's position is that Shaul Berlin was trying to create modern orthodoxy or something like that. I don't agree at all. Elishel Kalbach, Talia Fishman, I think, is also more positive on Shaul Berlin. I, on the other hand, see Shaul Berlin the same way that the Chasam Sofer saw him, the same way that Rav Mordechai Banet saw him, the same way that the Gedol Yisrael saw him as a complete heretic intent on destroying traditional Judaism by slipping in false doctrines. I mean, he undermines everything. He undermines the idea of martyrdom. He undermines... the idea of principles of faith. He undermines Kitvei Kodesh. That is, in tshuva after tshuva, he undermines, he mocks the rabbis and mocks traditional Jewish learning. He says that because there's a machokas on everything, really, there's always going to be a suffix. You never can determine that anything's really forbidden. So that way, maybe we'll do a set, when we get into the 18th century, I'll do a separate class on Shaul Berlin. So how to write about him? You need to write about this. In fact, the Besamim Rosh, that's what it's called, is the first text of Reform Judaism. The first Reform halachic work is the Besamim Rosh. That's what he called it. Now, the Stifler, in reply to this man who wanted to write about how evil and wicked Shaul Berlin was, destroyed Judaism, he says to him, don't write about Shaul Berlin. And he gives four reasons. One, the honor due to his forefathers. Rav Shaul Berlin came from an important rabbinic family. We don't want to embarrass. We want to give honor to his family. We don't want people. We don't want to talk about what came out of this family. It would detract from his family honor if people knew Shaul Berlin's story. His second reason is that perhaps Shaul Berlin's soul has already received its punishment in heaven, and it's been cleansed. Therefore, bringing up this episode now could harm his soul in the world to come. It would have to be, you know, it's been almost 200 years, so by now maybe he received his due, his punishment. Those are the first two reasons the Stiper gives. I think the most important reasons, though, are the last two. He says that discussion of this episode will be humiliating to those sages who stood by Shaul Berlin, having been taken in by the forgery. There were many great rabbis who didn't recognize it as a forgery. And they stood by Shaul Berlin. 20 years ago, a book was published in Jerusalem with notes in the back showing all the great rabbis who didn't realize it was a forgery, especially certain Sephardic rabbis who defend it, including Rabbi Shlomo Moshe Chazan, who we had classes on, who think that this is an authentic work and reject the Chasam Sofer, reject Mordechai Bennett. The problem with these rabbis is they don't know who Shaul Berlin is. They just have the Sefer. They see he's a great Talmud Chacham with his notes. And they say, well, you find in all books, you find unusual and rare Psakim. So it just so happens that we have some very unusual stuff. And if you could tell me that we have a response where the Rush speaks about the value of secular studies, when in his other tshuvot he doesn't, he opposes secular studies, okay, so he changes his mind. The problem is these rabbis don't know who Shaul Berlin was. They don't know his personal history, how he became a maskil, how he published an anonymous, vicious attack on Rav Raphael Cohen, who was the Rav of Hamburg, of Ahu, Altena, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. The author of this anonymous pamphlet, Mitzvah Yekatzeh, was put in Cheirim by all the Gedolim, including by Ritzvi Levin, the Rav of Berlin, and then he finds out that it's his own son who wrote this work, and he has to backtrack. He becomes a member of the Maasef circle, he's a maskil. So, I mean, it's unbelievable that these rabbis who know nothing about, it's as if you could take Aaron Horan, a Reform rabbi that we'll deal with, when we speak about the Chasam Sofer, and you look at one of his halachic works before he becomes a reformer, and you think, hey, this is a real great Talmud Chacham, you know nothing about his life. Or I could show you Chidushei Torah by Yaakov Klatskin. Yaakov Klatskin, who becomes an atheist and a leading Zionist, who wants the Jews to be normalized, no different than anyone else, no revelation, no nothing. We should be just like any other nation. And you're going to say he's one of the Gedolei Yisrael because in his early life he wrote Chidushei Torah. It's laughable. And we have many, many figures like this. or the rabbis. I don't need to go into the details. You get the point. But the Stiper gives two other reasons. One of them, the rabbis would be taken in, who are taken in by the forgery, and if we show who Shaul Berlin was, this shows that these rabbis had terribly poor judgment, that they were taken in. And then the final reason, and I think the final reason is the most important reason. The Stiper says that the faith of certain people will be weakened, seeing that one who was regarded as a great Torah sage ended up becoming a heretic. In other words, the simple people believe that the more Torah you earn, the greater you become. The idea that you could be a great Torah sage and just give it up, I mean, that would hurt the simple people. That would hurt their faith. This is not something they can understand. Obviously, the intellectuals, they all know about Elisha ben Avuya Acher, so memorably portrayed by Milton Steinberg in his novel. The intellectuals all know about people like Aaron Chorin, who was a great Torah scholar, like Louis Ginsberg, who maybe was the greatest Torah scholar in America before World War II, and he goes over to the conservatives, so they know about this. But the simple people, that he says they can't handle. There would be terrible results if that became known. And therefore he says, you could talk about how bad Haskalah is and how they tried to destroy Judaism, but don't mention the name of the Torah scholars who were led astray. I think that really explains a lot about how Haredi society functions in terms of the information. In Charei society, there are those who have the information and those for whom the information is to be kept from them. A former teacher at BMT, where I went to school, was one of the English language editors of Yatei Ne'eman. He told me that his job was like in Pravda. They were supposed to determine what the masses were supposed to know. That is, some people, to use a famous expression from a movie, can't handle the truth. And these people are not supposed to know the truth, and any intellectuals who know the truth. Charei society has, it's structured this way. You have the elites with the information, then you have the masses, and even among the masses, you have to distinguish between the masses who are men and the masses who are women. The women are on a lower level. The men, at least, have studied Talmud. They're a little more sophisticated. The women are lower. And that's his answer, that our job is to keep this information from the masses. The intellectuals, they know all about Shaul Berlin. They don't need to be told. The masses, we can't let them in on this because this would hurt their faith. And for that reason, we can't let them know about certain great rabbis who became Zionists. We have to censor these books. Go on Yatei Ne'eman's website, Deyavet Dibur. The front homepage has an article, Why We Censor. And it explains that we don't tell you the truth and we censor because some episodes might be embarrassing to family members or others. So if your family member used to like be in Rav Kook's circle, that could be embarrassing, so we're going to censor it. If your family member went to Yeshiva University and now you're a Haredi, you don't want people to know, so we'll just censor it. Or if you're a bystander, it said it could hurt, have negative effects on bystanders. So a bystander might look and see that this great Torah sage, like Rabbi Yechezkel Sarna, actually signed a letter talking about how important the state of Israel was, and that's the beginning, it's the first step for the redemption. And he's a so-called Haredi Rav, or you might see other great rabbis who had respect for Rav Kook, and that might create problems for you because the Das Torah you have says you're not supposed to do that. So therefore, we need to censor. In other words, the Haredi society is built on this idea. It's based. The whole structure of Das Torah is based on the fact that you have to cover things up and keep information from the masses, because the only way you can perpetuate a notion of Das Torah, that there's only one Torah approach, you can only do it in two ways. One, by showing that the other rabbis who oppose it are not really authorities, so therefore people like Rabbi Soloveitchik become nobodies. But then you have another problem, because there are certain rabbis who actually are in the Haredi world who don't have the Das Torah perspective. They have a different perspective. So therefore, their views have to be covered up and censored, so that enables you to... Because if it became known that these Gedolim who are in the canon had a different perspective, then how does Yatei and how does the Das Torah today, the regnant Das Torah, how is that passed on? Because the masses will say, hey, wait a second, what about this rabbi? He's a great rabbi, but he had a different perspective. So there has to be one perspective. Now, I do think, however, that the Steichler was unaware of an important point, which might have led him to give a different answer. Many Torah scholars, even today, are unaware of who Shaul Berlin was. I don't know Samim Rosh. I mean, the Steichler's assumption is that all the intellectuals, the Torah scholars, they know who Shaul Berlin was, and the masses don't need to know. But the truth is that many Torah scholars don't know who Shaul Berlin was, and that's why the book could be published 20 years ago by someone actually writing a defense of Shaul Berlin, that he is really one of the Gedol Yisrael. I see it's already 10 o'clock. Before we get to questions, I just want to know, we still have a little bit of time next class. I'm going to deal with the Steipler's famous letter and his polemic against the Gerach Hasidim on asceticism. The Gerach Hasidic movement is as ascetic and as Christian-like when it comes to sexual matters as you can be and still be a Torah Jew. That is, Torah Jews believe you have to have children. But... other than having children, we're talking almost complete celibacy. And this is something that the Steipler thought was very dangerous. And how out of Torah Judaism do you get such a philosophy, which basically is advocating viewpoints in opposition to the Talmud, in opposition to the Ketubah, in opposition to everything that we're always taught? And this is what's the Steipler, why he writes an essay, which at first was not published. He didn't want it to be published. It was kept, it was given from person to person, and it was published, I guess you could say, illegally. And then once it got out into the world, it was published. The Steipler did not want to go public, but he wanted people to know his position. So we will deal with the Steipler's position, which is, I think many of you listening will say, after hearing all the stuff from the Steipler, which was problematic, for those of us with a more modern religious Zionist perspective, and is not mentioned in the Art Scroll biography, we will then come to another position, which I think all of you are going to say, well, that makes a lot more sense. And this position, too, is not mentioned in any of the popular English writings, even though out of all the Steiffler's letters, this is the one that I think is the most influential and will stand the test of time, because he really takes on this creeping, almost a Greek perspective on the physical matter. The traditional Jewish view, at least for the last few hundred years, is a much more positive view of physicality, and at least in joining it together with spirituality. So we will deal with that. I also want to deal with the Steiffler's, just briefly, the Steiffler's dispute with Rav Menashe Klein, which also is an affirmation of the value of Kirov and of reaching out to others. And then just a few interesting things from the Steiffler, including the Steiffler's view about this Upsharon, that it has become so popular in the modern Orthodox world. Suffice it to say that the Steiffler did not look kindly upon the Lithuanian world adopting this practice. And a couple other things, and perhaps it'll be time next class to finally begin with the Chasam Sofer. But we still have some good things we need to do. I will now take some questions. Let me, Shlomo, thank you very much for sending me the picture of Chaim Kanievsky. I will show that next class. I'm going to repeat the question only because I've been reminded so many times. What is a maskil? What is a haskalah exactly? Is it anti-religious writing? Well, there's different types of haskalah. It's a good question. Haskalah meant different things in Germany than in Eastern Europe, for example, in Vilna. Haskalah was like modern Orthodoxy. The haskalah Jews had beards, and they were pious, and Shomer Shabbos, and Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan Spector was very close and friendly with many of these maskilim. On the other hand, in Germany, in Galicia, in Hungary, Haskalah meant something else. It meant a desire to fit in, to be like, to really adopt non-Jewish dress and non-Jewish practices, non-Jewish language. It comes to mean very quickly a rejection of rabbinic authority. It's the first step on the way to either reform or assimilation. It's a rejection of the authority of the rabbis. It's a return to Hebrew and the Bible, which is authentic Judaism, as opposed to the distortions of the rabbis. So Haskalah in Western Europe and in Hungary is an anti-rabbinic phenomenon. Haskalah in Eastern Europe is different. It's not anti-rabbinic. Oh, it's a cipher in the picture. Okay, thank you. I would have showed it today, but I'll show it next class. I didn't look that carefully at the picture. Ah, so Sean was clarifying. He was the great-nephew of Rav Yaakov Emden. Well, that I could have told you that he was in Rav Yaakov Emden's family. And I think that's probably Rabbi Eric Heffet, he was confused with Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Eric Heffet. I mean, Rabbi Yaakov Emden and the Note of Yehuda. The Note of Yehuda, I mean, Rav Yaakov Emden has a great rabbinic family as well. And for next class, I'll get the exact relationship with Rav Yaakov Emden. Who had a bigger role in creating Haredism, the Steiffler or Rav Aaron Cutler? I think the Steiffler did, because Haredism as an ideology really comes out of Israel. Rav Aaron Cutler was extremely successful. He created an American form of, on the American scene, obviously it's Rav Aaron Cutler. But in terms of Haredism as an ideology, and as the political force, it's the Steiffler. But each were of great significance. Bill, I'm assuming they're all related. All these rabbis were related to one another. No one, as far as I know, has made a chart of all the great rabbis and the intermarriage between them all. And what's great is that Rav Yaakov Emden, for example, can be mechutan with someone who he's total enemies with. And Note of Yehuda's mechutan, his in-law, he has this great battle with. This is no different than the royalty in Europe when you'd have one king and another king, and the son and daughter would marry each other, and yet they'd go to war. That is, the in-laws would go to war with each other. You had the entire rabbinic elite of Eastern Europe was intermarried, and one with the other. Because the only people they would marry would either be maybe some rich person or another rabbinic elite. Rav Yaakov Emden speaks all about his marriage and other marriages. He gives you all details. There's a great doctoral dissertation on the Rabbi Yehuda by David Katz. He's a rabbi in Baltimore, and he gives you all the details. But I will get the exact, for next class, I will get the exact genealogy. I think I know it, but I don't want to misspeak. So rather than me telling you exactly who's who was married to who, which rabbi, which city, wait a week. Let's have a little patience. And by next class, I'll give you the exact rabbinic figures, if we can wait. Okay, Ashlomo, I'm going to check it. I'll get the details. I have plenty of books that I can look for. I didn't think that he was the nephew, because I know who the siblings are of the Notab Yehuda, or who the siblings aren't. I mean, I know who they aren't. So Yisrael asks, did that create genetic issues? I think it probably did create genetic issues in that you had many geniuses. But I don't know if there were genetic issues of the sort you're referring to. And I'm really speaking here about the 18th century. Once you get into the 19th century, you don't have the same... You do have a lot of marriages, obviously children of great rabbis, but you have many more great rabbis. There's an increase in population, I sense, and it's not the same ones over and over again. In the 18th century, it seems that of these families that come out of Poland and then become the leaders in Germany, because the leaders of Poland come from Germany, the leaders of Germany come from Poland, it seems that there's just a few families, a couple families, and they are constantly marrying with each other. It is almost incestuous. Once you get to the 19th century in Russia and Poland, already you have many, many families, so you wouldn't have any genetic issues. Did the Stipor teach formally? No, he didn't teach formally. I mean, he would give shiurim occasionally, and we have famous pictures of him sitting in the front of the Beis Medrash. But he was never a Rosh Yeshiva per se, but he did give shiurim occasionally. But I don't know, maybe someone knows better whether there was an actual schedule. People would come and talk and learning with him all the time, but he was not officially associated at the Kol Chazal Nish. Perhaps he would come and give, but it's not like he had a position as a Rosh Yeshiva per se. After he left Navardic, if he was in Navardic Yeshiva at first, and he was there, but then he would retire. But when he first comes to the land of Israel, he's in the Navardic Yeshiva. That's what, like I said, he was sent there. And then, of course, he gave shiurim. But I think that by the early 1970s, he's no longer officially involved in the Yeshiva. You'd have to check it out, though. But yes, in Europe he gave shiurim, and he comes to America. And he comes to Israel at first, he was at the Yeshiva. How could the Stipor do a Shidduch with Rav Yashiv? He's in Heichal Shlomo. Because I think you have to say with the Stipor, like you say with others, that sometimes the rhetoric is harsher than the reality. He had a great deal of respect for Rav Yashiv. In fact, when people came to ask the Stipor halacha questions, he would send them to Rav Yashiv, because the Stipor did not regard himself as a posek. The fact that he would send them to Rav Yashiv shows that he had a good deal of respect for them. It was a dispute on hashkafa issues. I don't think he ever would have made a shidduch with a religious Zionist rabbi, but he knew that Rav Yashiv was not a religious Zionist rabbi. He simply was a rabbi who thought that it was acceptable to work in the government and involve oneself in it. So that's a dispute, for example, like he had with the Satmar. The Satmar said it was forbidden to be involved, have any, even vote, or have members of parliament. And yet, if you read the Stipor's letters, he has an enormous amount of respect for the Eda Charedit and for the Satmar, and he would have definitely done a shidduch with a member of the Satmar's family, Satmar Rav's family. So just because he disagreed with the position doesn't mean that he didn't respect those who disagreed. It depends what the position is. Religious Zionism is an idol. He says explicitly it's an idol. And anyone who's a religious Zionist, as far as he's concerned, has made such an error, it's questionable whether he can be regarded as an Erlich Jew. He does say in one place that someone who is a religious Zionist, we can't speak Lashon Hara about them because they don't know any better, even though it's a terrible mistake. With the rabbis, it could be that he thought that they were more guilty because they knew better. But if you're dealing with someone who is not a Zionist and doesn't accept the idolatry of religious Zionism, simply believes for Kirov or whatever purposes, you can work with the religious Zionist, that he doesn't have as negative a position. Next question, why are so many extremist figures leaders in our era? Rav Aaron Cutler, the Stifler, Rav Shach? It's a good question. Some people have said that people are looking for extremism. People are looking, moderation is not something that people are attracted to in this era. And extremist leaders also have a way of silencing and of scaring others. Rav Aaron Cutler had a strong personality, and he was able to dominate the other Rosh Yeshiva, and I'm not going to say intimidate, because that has a negative connotation. I'm going to say put them in awe of him. They were not willing to go up against him. And the same thing with Rav Shach and the Stipler. Extreme positions have become very attractive in our era. Other positions are more complicated, it's more difficult. It's the era we're in. And Rav Aaron Cutler, let's not forget, Rav Aaron Cutler did not achieve his significance in his lifetime. I think when he passed away, there were 200 students in Lakewood. The victory of the Lakewood yeshiva ideology comes in the next generation, beginning in the 70s, late 1970s, 1980s. It is part and parcel of what's happening in the land of Israel. And if you look in the 1960s, you say the future was in yeshivas like Chaim Berlin, Torah Vadas, and where they go to college at night. And looked around today, who talks about Chaim Berlin? Who talks about Torah Vadas? These are second-rate places, almost. These are regarded as second-rate, as minor league. If you want the major leagues, you want to go to Lakewood. You go to Eretz Yisrael. The idea of these compromises that you're going to go to college at night, that's not what's pushing American Haredi society today. Rav Aaron Cutler did not allow Rav Ruderman to be on the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah because Rabbi Ruderman's perspective was that you go to college at night, and they had the agreement with Johns Hopkins and later with Towson State. But Rav Aaron knew what Rav Ruderman's perspective was, and he did not think that the Rosh Yeshiva of such a yeshiva was worthy of being on the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. Okay, we'll take one or two more questions. How do I define the term Gadol? Because these questions will go on forever. You could have a whole class on it. Is it a leader or just the next level in scholarship up from a Talmud Chacham? A Gadol, in my opinion, is simply it's a social construct. It's the community determines who a Gadol is. A Gadol doesn't mean someone who knows a lot. I can show you people. There are certain so-called American Gedolim, on the Aguda Moses Gedolei Torah. There are plenty of people who know a lot more than them. But first of all, you have to have a position as a Rav or a Rosh Yeshiva. You need to have a following. Remember how Ramosha Feinstein described how he became the Gadol? People started asking questions, and they liked his answers, so they asked him more questions. You need to be in the right place in the right time. So it is a leader. And this leader needs to have great piety, you need to think that this leader has great piety and great scholarship. But it's not enough to have the piety, and it's not enough to have the scholarship. You need to have all, and you need to have the people who are attracted to you. That's what makes them a Gadol. But don't assume that because someone's a Gadol that he knows more, or he's more pious even than someone else. There are plenty of people who know more than all these people categorize as Gedolim. But they're unknown people. They could be living in Meir Sha'arim and just on their own. Glenn says that was an issue when Weimer was kicked off the Moetzes Gedolei of Aguda. Yeah. See, eventually they had to put Rabbi Ruderman in because he was quite elderly. He was a senior Rosh Yeshiva. But Ner Yisrael was always viewed as problematic. More problematic than places like Chaim Berlin because Ner Yisrael, they instituted it officially. It was part of the program. It wasn't just that you went to college at night. It was part of the program. And this is no secret. Everyone knows that the Rosh Yeshiva at Ner Yisrael were more moderate. And their form of Haredi Judaism did not take off, but don't write them out. The next 30 years, things could be very different. Haredi Judaism in Israel, Torah only, could collapse. If you look at what they achieved in Baltimore, they achieved a Haredi community in which everyone makes a living, in which they are part of a community, which values working. I mean, that is a very attractive Haredi perspective, and that could emerge over time as the dominant Haredi viewpoint. Let's not forget, the only way that a place like Lakewood survives is because they come to the modern Orthodox world. They came not too far from me in Springfield, New Jersey. All the modern Orthodox rabbis from all over here. There was an evening, like a breakfast, or there was an evening, I forget which one. And all the local modern Orthodox rabbis were here, and they tried to recruit people, and everyone gives them tzedakah. Of course, you can't go into Lakewood. They're never going to have a breakfast or a dinner in Lakewood. It's going to raise money for any of the institutions in these rabbis' towns. So as soon as the modern Orthodox rabbis stop supporting these places, either because they choose to for ideological reasons, for economic reasons, Lakewood and places like that have real trouble. On the other hand, Ner Yisrael, their model, they can be self-sufficient because their people actually go out and work. Look at all the Lakewood coal wells. I was just in St. Louis 2 weeks ago. That's why I couldn't be here 2 weeks ago. You have a Lakewood coal well. Who supports the Lakewood coal well? You don't have Haredim living in St. Louis. These are all the modern Orthodox. And that's the way it is in all these places. Livingston, New Jersey, right next to where I am now. There's no Haredim in the whole city. They don't even live there. They come during the day and go home at night. Rich, modern Orthodox Jews support this. So that's why it's tenuous, because if the rich, modern Orthodox Jews ever decide to stop supporting it, it's going to be a problem. Okay, so let's end now. It's already 10:20. Thank you very much for your questions, your comments. I think we'll have one more class with the Stipor, and then we move on to really the most important figure in the last 200 years, I think, and that is the Chasam Sofer. That is the most important figure in Orthodoxy. Good night, everyone.